This program is about unsolved mysteries. Whenever possible, the actual family members and police officials have participated in recreating the events. What you are about to see is not a news broadcast.
In New Hampshire, freak accidents take the lives of a mother and her son 25 years apart. Some believe that Rena and Danny Paquette were in reality murdered because he had seen the face of the same killer. In Aurora, Illinois, LaVelda Richmond was injured in a car crash on a lonely country road. Simultaneously, her identical twin sister, Lavona, claims that she saw the accident from her living room 20 miles away. Could this be a case of ESP between identical twins? And FBI Director William Sessions will announce the latest addition to the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list. Perhaps you can help track down a serial child molester. Also, we have a heartwarming update from our story of a Tennessee adoption home which abducted children and sold them to wealthy clients. After our broadcast, one of those orphans was reunited with her two brothers after a 30-year separation. You can share in their joyous reunion tonight. Unsolved Mysteries. Hooksett, New Hampshire was home to 2,500 people, many of them farmers. The surrounding woods concealed an abundant population of deer that attracted hunters from all over New England. But by the winter of 1964, a hunter of a different kind had arrived in the area. Two teenage girls had been found murdered after having first been tortured. The second victim was a 15-year-old high school sophomore named Pamela Mason. It was thought that her killer lived in the area. A neighbor regarded neighbor with suspicion. One area resident had good reason to be frightened. 47-year-old Rena Paquette told her friends and family that she believed she knew who had killed the two teenage girls. At the time, nobody took her seriously. February 3rd, 1964. Rena's son, 13-year-old Danny Paquette, had the day off from school.
Mom?
Danny and Rena were alone at the family farm, but when the boy came down for breakfast, his mother was gone.
Uncle Charlie, this is Danny speaking. Yeah, I can't find my mom. Well, she said she was gonna take me to the dentist today.
When Danny got up morning, he couldn't find my mother.
All right, bye.
Dan couldn't understand where she was because her purse and her winter coat were there, and it was extremely bitterly cold, and it was highly unlikely that she went anywhere without her coat or her purse.
She's not in there, Uncle Charlie.
Let's try the big barn for you.
Danny's uncle immediately came over to help look for Rena. Though the two searched for over an hour, Rena was nowhere to be found.
Rena! Smoke! Smoke! Mom? No, it's Mom!
Danny.
No, Danny. Mom!
Rena Paquette was dead. Her charred body was found in the Paquette barn, 1 mile from the family home. Police concluded that she had somehow set herself on fire and then crawled into the barn to die. However, no flammable substances or containers were found near the area. Though her death was ruled a suicide, her other son, Victor, believes that she was murdered.
And I don't really believe my mother committed suicide because of the tremendous amount of fear and panic in the community, because of the two earlier brutal murders that I think it was just kind of like kept on a very low profile, not to create more public hysteria.
I feel at the time of my mother's death, the person that was found to be the person responsible for killing the young Pamela Mason girl was the same person that was responsible for my mother's death.
In February of 1964, a local delivery man was arrested, convicted, and sentenced to life in prison for the murder of Pamela Mason. At long last, the nightmare seemed over. But 20 years later, Rena's son Danny was also found dead, gunned down in front of his house. There are those who believe that Danny and his mother both died for the same reason. They knew too much. Though Rena Paquette left behind five children, her son Danny seemed the most affected by her death. His brother Victor became his closest friend.
Mom being killed was very traumatic for Danny. I think everybody's mom is a little security blanket. And from there, you lose that. Emotionally, it leads to a lot of problems.
Danny grew from a troubled adolescent into a troubled adult. He married, became a father, but then divorced in 1981. In a bitter legal battle, Danny lost custody of his children.
I believe that Danny loved his children more than anything. I'm sure that Danny was extremely upset, angered at the thought of losing his children. It would, of course, mean to him another loss.
Dee!
In the summer of 1983, frustrated by not being allowed to see his children,
Dee!
Danny went to his former wife's home.
Dee!
Dee, what are you doing here? What are you doing here?
Dee, I want to see the kids. I haven't seen them in a month now. Open the door.
You're not going to see the kids. You're not even supposed to be around here.
Dee, I'm telling you, if I have to come through this plate glass door, I want to see my kids.
I'm going to call the cops.
Call the cops.
After this frightening outburst, Danny's former wife called police. They took him into custody.
Now, I'm going to take you back to February the 3rd, 1964.
Danny was ordered to undergo psychiatric examination at the Concord State Mental Hospital. It was during this time that the tragedy from his past began to catch up with his present. Under hypnosis, Danny began to recall details of the morning that his mother was killed.
I remember, I woke up because I heard, I heard voices. It's my mom's voice, and
you know what you're doing to me by doing this stuff?
You're lying. There's a man's voice.
You don't know me, I'm not gonna.
He was a delivery man, and he was yelling at my mother. And I remember I went back to my room. I was scared.
Danny became convinced that he had seen his mother's murderer. He told friends that he was certain that the killer was the same delivery man imprisoned for the murder of Pamela Mason. However, there has never been any evidence to support this belief.
How's things going here anyway?
During this troubled time, Danny's brother would visit every day. And when Danny was released after 5 months, he found that Victor had paid all of his bills.
Mailed out.
After Danny went home, he tried to pick up the pieces of his life. He and Victor would spend many afternoons together, motorcycling through the countryside.
We spent time together and we started to enjoy life. It was a real turning point for him.
Saturday morning, November 9th, 1985. Danny was repairing a bulldozer while two of his friends worked on a car in the garage. At 11 a.m., Danny's friends heard a loud pop.
I ran up towards where Danny was working. It appeared to me that he'd been electrocuted. We noticed the air escaping from a hole in the middle of his chest. And I thought that it was a welding probe that he fell on when he hit the ground. I the time, I didn't know it was a bullet wound.
Staying in, I'm just looking around. Something wrong here.
Danny Paquette had been shot through the heart with a single bullet. He died instantly. After police arrived, they discovered footprints behind Danny's house where the bullet may have come from. The distance between the individual footprints raised the possibility that someone had been running from the scene.
A search of the area revealed about 50 to 80 yards away footprints heading toward the woods. Whether it was coincidental or, in fact, someone's footprint that was fleeing the scene is speculative at this time. Telephone service had been interrupted at about the time Danny was shot. Their linemen had discovered a projectile in the telephone cable. We did recover a bullet from it that was in line with Danny's position.
Yeah, it looks pretty much like it.
Investigators determined that the bullet in the telephone line was the same one that had killed Danny. The day of Danny's death was also the beginning of hunting season, and police began to theorize that he had been shot accidentally. In order to test this theory, they tried to pinpoint the location of the gunman.
We were able to ascertain that there were hunters in a gravel pit approximately a mile away that were sighting their weapons in at the time.
If Danny was shot accidentally, the fatal bullet may have come from this gravel pit. For this to happen, the bullet had to travel nearly a mile, climb 1,000 feet, pass through Danny, and lodge in the telephone wire. In the summer of 1990, ballistics expert R.J. Breglia was brought in from New York City in order to determine if such a shot could have occurred. After examining the locations, Breglia concluded that such a shot would have been impossible.
I would rule out the possibility that it was an accident, that the gun was fired from a mile or more away. Rather, it was a shot fired in the vicinity, deliberately.
You would have to traverse through woods, would have to travel around vehicles, get through a 24-inch opening on a bulldozer and hit somebody directly through the heart before being projected upwards into the telephone cable. I think that's very hard to believe that that could happen. I'm not any expert, but I just don't buy that.
If anybody thinks that I'm gonna lay down or go away on this one, oh, they're wrong. We as a family are, I think, pretty well determined that the system is going to have to work. The system is going to have to get out there and do its job.
Was Danny Paquette the victim of a freak hunting accident? Danny? Or was he deliberately murdered?
Danny, if you knew anything about me...
Did someone want him silenced about what he claimed to have witnessed the morning of his mother's death?
You've been telling everybody in town that I did something that I did not do.
I got Danny upstairs.
I don't care about Danny.
Let's go outside.
Fine. Or did someone just want Danny dead? No one knows. In 1949, the Tennessee Children's Home Society in Memphis was considered a model orphanage. Director Georgia Tan was credited with placing 5,000 orphans with new families and won national praise for her efforts. But Georgia Tan's orphanage had a darker side.
When I was growing up, I was told that I was adopted from Memphis, Tennessee. After my adopted mother passed away, I found correspondence from the Tennessee Children's Home. And that's when I started my search. 2.5 years later, I found my name. 2 hours later, I found my mother.
Come on, come on over here! Come on over here!
Cindy LaPresto discovered that her mother had never placed her for adoption.
I was playing on the playground, and Georgia Tan drove up in her proverbial black limousine.
Okay, George, let's go home now.
Georgia Tan had simply abducted Cindy.
Good morning, children.
A few days later, Judge Camille Kelly ordered that custody of Cindy be given to the Tennessee Children's Home Society.
Miss Tan?
Thank you, Judge Kelly.
I'm confident that Camille Kelly was involved with Georgia Tan in this operation. Georgia Tan could not have carried it on without her, and Camille Kelly could not have lived in the style she lived unless she had outside income.
In 1950, Robert Taylor investigated Georgia Tan and the Tennessee Children's Home Society. He discovered that Tan was using the orphanage as a cover for a black market baby ring and that she was making a fortune in the process. On September 12, 1950, Robert Taylor presented his report to the governor of Tennessee. 3 days later, Georgia Tan died of cancer. 2 months later, Judge Camille Kelly resigned. The Tennessee Children's Home Society was shut down.
I get very angry when I think of Georgia Tan and Camille Kelly because of what they've done to me and thousands of other people. It makes me very angry because my mother missed my growing up, and those years can never be replaced. We've been robbed.
Tonight, we are pleased to announce that because of our broadcast, another orphan from the Tennessee Children's Home Society has been reunited with her family. Lynn Hines was 5 years old when she was adopted by a wealthy California couple.
I was adopted into a very, very fine family, but there wasn't a lot of love in the family. And even though, you know, you try to make the adopted child part of the family, you're always still just a little bit different. And so it meant a great deal to me to find that I really had a true family.
Lynn was born Martha Jean Gookin and was placed in Georgia Tan's orphanage in 1949. She never saw or heard from her natural family again. Then just 3 weeks after our broadcast, Lynn learned that her father and two brothers, Paul and Randall, were still living in Tennessee.
One of the things that I had been fearful of is that the family did not want me to find them. When I did finally get hold of Randall, Randall said, if you don't come here, we're coming there. Like tomorrow. You know, it wasn't soon enough.
The next day, Lynn flew from her home in Denver, Colorado, and saw her brothers for the first time in more than 40 years.
She walked off the plane, I knew she was just like that. She's a spitting image of her mother, a very spitting image.
When you have this void that had never been filled, but it was.
That afternoon, Randall and Paul took Lynn to meet their 86-year-old father, Rufus Gookin.
Yeah. I had pictures of myself when I was adopted that the adopted parents had taken, and they had pictures of Randall and I and mother before I had been adopted. So we naturally had to compare all our pictures and all that type of thing, and I guess we decided that we really were brothers and sisters. It was very exciting, very thrilling.
As we grew older, why, we just always had the thought there, the love there, but she wasn't there.
Do you want me to take it with me when I leave?
You're just like yesterday, you know. Somebody to love, be loved by, that you never had before.
I would have to say that this is like Christmas, New Year's, everything rolled up into one. When I found the family, I felt like I was queen for a day, and oh, nothing else.
Over 15 million sets of identical twins living in the world today. Throughout history, they have fascinated and delighted us all. Their mirror images are a perfect example of nature's whimsy. The physical similarities of identical twins can easily be explained by genetics, but in the three stories you're about to see, these eerie likenesses go beyond the realm of science and defy explanation. Mark Newman and Jerry Levy are identical twin brothers who were separated at birth. For 32 years, neither one knew the other existed. When they met for the first time 3 years ago, they were amazed to discover that their uncanny resemblance was more than skin deep.
The first time we met, when we went into the bathroom and looked in the mirror, it was a little spooky. Now I was seeing four of my faces instead of just the one when I normally look in the mirror. I graduated in 72.
Incredibly, Mark and Jerry's separate lives and personal habits were nearly identical. Both are volunteer firemen and have worked in the lawn care industry. Both are confirmed bachelors. They always drink the same brand of beer, and they even carry their keys in the same distinctive manner.
We were instantly comfortable with each other. The only way I could explain it was almost like a brother who moved away for 32 years and then came back and, you know, what have you been doing for the last 32 years? And as it turned out, we were doing the same exact things.
My uncle.
And still, after, you know, 32 years of separation, it was like there wasn't any separation. Our lives were basically parallel.
That's too much coincidence. Too much.
These identical twins reared apart are remarkably alike on almost everything we look at.
Okay, Mark and Jerry, let's have you stand up against the wall over here.
Mark and Jerry are alike in a wide array of ways. They have a lot of gestures and postures that are the same. They tend to hold their beer can in the same way. They tend to laugh in the same way. There's kind of a cycle and a pattern to their laughter. And I've watched them sit in chairs and just watch the way they cross their legs, things of that sort. There's a whole pattern to their behavior that's very much alike. Now, that raises the question, how is it that two individuals reared apart in entirely different environments come 40 years later when they're reunited to be so similar? We really, as scientists, simply do not know.
In some cases, the unique bond between identical twins is even more mystifying. Some identical twins claim to have paranormal experiences, such as telepathic communication, or ESP, and even a bizarre phenomenon known as shared pain. Scientists can neither dismiss nor explain these strange occurrences.
There's a saying among twins that's very, very common. It's us against the world. So when we go back to back, we can see 360 degrees. We're not blindsided. We see things that other people don't, and we protect each other.
Identical twins Lewis and Donald Keith have lived in separate cities for most of their lives, but believe they are connected by a sixth sense. They even claim to have experienced shared pain. The first incident occurred 3 years ago while Lewis was working out at a health club in Chicago.
I took a swim, I did a few bicycle exercises, and I tried this exercise which had been told to me was good for getting rid of those, I guess they're colloquially called love handles, that everybody would like to get rid of. Anyway, I tried the exercise. It was going along very well. It's not difficult, it's not painful, it doesn't take any great intellectual talent, but I hurt myself. It was probably the most intense pain that I ever felt in my life.
At that exact moment, Donald was over 500 miles away at his office just outside of Washington, D.C.
I had some papers to Xerox at the office, and as I was walking down the corridor, there was this pain in my right groin area. This pain was unlike any that I had ever experienced in my life, and then it was gone. And I wondered, what was the pain and what caused it? Later that day, I called Lewis, and his secretary said that he had injured himself and he was home. And then my curiosity got the best of me, and
curiosity
I said,
or sixth sense?
I don't know. I really don't know whether it was curiosity or sixth sense, but I wanted to know where you hurt yourself. And then I found out that he had injured himself in the same place that I felt this pain. And then I asked him about the time. And when the time clicked, I remember distinctly the hair on the back of my neck standing up. It was electric. I could just feel every hair sticking straight out. The experience of sharing pain proved again that we were identical twins, again that we were very close, again that psychologically and psychically we were able to communicate with us. It didn't surprise it. It just confirmed what we already knew.
We feel pain for each other. Whenever anything happens to one, the other one can experience it, like if they're going through the same thing herself.
For example, I fell downstairs at school. They came in to tell my sister they were taking me to the hospital, and she was unconscious.
Lavona and Lavelda Richmond were born in 1933 and have lived together ever since. Even after they married their identical twin husbands, Alwyn and Arthur.
We are what they call identical mirror image twins. Our medical history has been pretty much the same throughout our life.
In fact, when one gets ill anymore, they check the other one to make sure she's going to be okay.
We've had tonsils taken out together.
We've had breast biopsies the same time.
And we had major surgery together.
Now, eye correction is the same except for opposite eyes.
My left eye is my weak eye. And
my right eye is my weak eye.
And our cavities have appeared on opposite sides.
Lavona and Lavelda have taken part in many scientific studies of twin behavior. In one study, they were rated highest among the 300 sets of twins tested for extrasensory perception.
We feel among every set of twins, one is the sender and one is the receiver. I happen to be the receiver.
And I am the sender.
And whenever Lavelda has been in an occasion where she has felt pain or has been in trouble, I have sensed it.
The most startling example of this unique psychic bond occurred in 1952. Lavelda was riding in a car with a young man who had asked her to join him in town for a cup of coffee.
Where are you going? The coffee shop's this way.
Relax, don't worry about it. We'll go somewhere nice and quiet where you and I can talk.
When this gentleman turned the opposite direction of what he was supposed to turn, I knew something was wrong. I got very, very uneasy. And I moved over as close to the passenger side of the door as I could. And the more he drove, the more agitated he got, and the more frightened I got. And I thought I was in trouble. Then when the car skidded, the only thing I could think of was, oh my God, what are they going to tell my sister?
And evidently, that's when I got the strong message, was when she started thinking of me, how I was going to react if something had happened to her. I was sitting in the living room studying. And all of a sudden, it's just like if I went into a trance. I could see what was happening, but I could not stop the vision from happening.
Lavona, what's wrong?
Dad, call the police.
The police? What for?
Sis has been in an accident.
And I told Father to call the police, and I could not convince him that Sis was in trouble.
She's hurt, Dad. She's been in an accident.
Now, how do you know?
I can see it. She's on a country road.
He told me I was jealous. I couldn't be with them. That this was the first time we had been separated for any event, and I better get used to it because there'd be other times that I would be separated from her also.
The car stopped just inches before plummeting into a water-filled ravine.
Are you okay?
Lavelda hit her head on the dashboard, but was not seriously hurt.
I did not see her hit her head on the dash at the time. What I did see was a farmer coming, with a tractor, pulling them out of a ditch, and I turned to Dad and said, it's all right, Dad. The danger is past. She's going to be okay.
See, Dad, I told you. You okay?
I was not surprised when Lavelda came in the house, showing a little bit wear for her adventure, because I could sense what was happening, and I knew what was happening. But I was surprised at Dad's reaction.
Listen, I don't say a word. Lavona, you said you saw this thing happen, right? We're going to get in the car right now, and you're going to take us to where this thing happened.
And I said to him, how am I going to do it, Dad? I've never been there. He said, you saw it. You can show me where it is.
Just keep going this way.
All right.
Dad asked Lavona which way to go, and she directed him. I sat in the back seat, and I kept very quiet all the way.
And as we were driving, I'd tell Dad, you turn here, Dad. He said, you ever been here before? I said, no. How do you know? I said, I feel it. Turn here.
And she directed Dad to the actual road. And when she got there, you could see the tire tracks where we went off and where we were pulled back onto the road.
This the place, honey?
Yes, it happened right here.
After we reached the crash site, he said, you were right. I never actually believed it could happen before. He said, I know you told me it has happened in the past, but he said, this is the first time I've actually saw it, and I would never doubt you again. If you tell me one of you is in danger, he said, I'll believe you.
Three intriguing stories, three sets of identical twins. Are they born with a paranormal ability to silently communicate? If you are an identical twin, perhaps you already know. The rest of us can only wonder. When we return, the poignant story of a Tennessee family's search for their missing sister. Our next story is about a family in the best sense of the word. A family that has survived hard times and endured to see better times. But for the Hinkle family of Tennessee, there is a sadness that the passing of 65 years has not managed to erode. It began when two infant girls were torn from their home. Tonight, with your help, those painful memories may finally be put to rest, and you may be able to help reunite a family. Greenville, Tennessee, a small rural community 60 miles northeast of Knoxville. It was the summer of 1924, and though the Great Depression was 5 years away, it had arrived earlier for the tobacco farmers who carved out a marginal living in the countryside. Times were tough that summer, and tenant farmer Rufus Hinkle was forced to make an agonizing decision. Shortly after giving birth to twin girls, Rufus's wife of 22 years had died. With nine other mouths to feed, Rufus felt incapable of making ends meet.
Where are you going with the twins?
Well, they're a little bit sick, son. Someone will take them to the hospital for a couple of weeks. Here, hold your sister while I get in the truck now. Be careful. Be careful with her now. Now, while I'm gone, son, Lloyd is in charge. So you pay attention to what Lloyd says, you hear me? You be a good boy.
He was a man that loved his family. He hated to part with any of us, especially the twins, but you got to sacrifice and just do the best you can do.
Bye, Mary. Bye, Martha. Bye, Papa.
Bye, son.
On that hot July afternoon in 1924, Rufus Hinkle took his two baby girls on a one-way trip to the orphanage. He hoped to reclaim Mary and Martha once his fortunes improved.
I'm sure that after he left the twins at the orphanage that he worried about them and thought about them a lot. And one of his sons, Lloyd, remembers going to the orphanage with Rufus to see about the twins and see if they could take them back.
Sadly, it was too late. The twins had already been given away.
We did try to place them together, but that was just not possible.
They'll be well taken care of, you say?
You don't have to worry about that. They're with fine families.
Well, must be the Lord's will.
I'm very sorry, Mr. Hinkle.
Thank you, ma'am.
Come on, son. We're going home.
Rufus Hinkle never saw his two daughters again. He passed away in 1950.
Later on, I heard that they would not tell us where they were at until my father died. So shortly after he died, we started looking for the twins and we found Mary.
In 1955, Rufus's son Shorty contacted the orphanage. Though unable to locate Martha, they were able to trace Mary. In September of that year, Shorty and his wife drove into Bluefield, West Virginia to meet the sister he never knew.
As we drove by, my wife said to me, said, right there she sat, said, I know that's her. She looks just like your brother. And sure, it was Mary. We know the first look that it was. And it was a very happy time, very.
Are you my
Mary. It's great to see you.
It was like finding a part of you that had always been missing. And just like putting something together, and when you put two and two together, you got a hole, you know. And it was just great.
Oh, it feels great to know that we'll all be together at times and be a family, and that they are part of me and part of my, I'm part of their blood, they're part of mine.
Why don't you come on over here and have a seat, let me take your picture.
Okay.
Sit down. Okay. Smile. Oh, great. You know, Shorty, it's amazing how much she looks like Dalton. I can't believe it.
She does.
That afternoon, Mary learned that she had a twin sister.
Mary, I've got some news for you. You have a twin sister named Martha.
Really?
Really.
I just don't kind of explain how I did feel, not knowing that I had a twin sister, a part of me.
Where is she?
Well, we don't know that exactly.
Shorty told Mary that the orphanage had lost track of Martha. She had never been officially adopted, but had instead been sent to a temporary home.
We can't seem to find her.
Oh. I've often wondered if it's been good or if Martha's life has been bad. You wonder about them things.
30 years later, Rufus's granddaughter, Jackie, took on the family quest.
Well, I started my search for Martha at Hostin Home for Children in Greenville, where she was placed along with Mary in 1924. And they showed me what records, you know, that they could, that were available.
Mary's.
Okay.
Records here.
Yeah.
In 1986, Jackie uncovered the original orphanage records.
Greenville, Tennessee.
She learned that in November of 1924, Martha had been given temporarily to a Charles and Lyda Meek in Johnson City, a small town 30 miles away from Greenville.
She adorable.
Oh, she is.
Oh,
wonderful.
Yes. So then I centered my search in Johnson City. And I went through old record books and census records and city directories and things of that sort. Went down Sydney Street where she was supposed to live. And I've never found any trace of the Meeks whatsoever, so I really don't know what happened to them from there.
Congratulations.
Not much is known about the Meeks, other than the fact that Charles was a 34-year-old farmer and a member of the Holiness Church. In April of 1990, three generations of Hinkles got together for a family reunion. There was only one person missing. Today, the family refuses to give up the search for Martha. They are certain that she is alive somewhere. They want her to become part of a family that has never stopped caring about one another.
Our family has been very close, but we're not a complete family without finding the other sister. And we found Mary, this was the part of it, but there's still a part of us missing yet.
Oh, it would just be the happiest day of my life to get to be reunited with my twin sister, Martha.
There are no known pictures of Martha, but there is a chance that Mary and Martha are identical twins. These photographs of Mary may help identify her lost sister. The first was taken when she was 8 years old. The second when she was 17. This is how Mary appears today. She and Martha were born in the spring of 1924. They were taken to the Holston Orphanage in Greenville, Tennessee, when they were 4 months old. Shortly after our broadcast, one of our viewers, Sandy Detain of San Bernardino, California, contacted the Hinkle family with surprising news. During a search for her mother's biological family, Sandy accidentally discovered the location of Martha Hinkle's adoptive family. Martha lived with John and Lida Meeks for 3 years. When the couple divorced, Martha was taken in by the Dan Jackson family of Johnson County, Georgia. In 1940, she married James Thomas, and together they had 4 sons. Sadly, Martha passed away just weeks before the Hinkle family could contact her.
I'm glad that I found her. We won't have to do no more searching. But it's so sad that I couldn't meet her, that I couldn't be with her just to talk to her just for an hour or two and tell her that I loved her.
Although she never realized her dream of meeting her twin sister, Mary's 35-year search was not in vain. On July 27th, 1991, Martha's 4 sons met Mary and a side of the family they had never known. That day, at a bittersweet reunion, two families came together as one.
We were part of the family before we ever walked up and touched the one of them. It was written all over their faces. When we saw those smiles and tender hearts, all the little fears, big fears, the apprehensions just left. It was all over with. We were glad to be home with our family.
I'm proud that she left 4 sons, left part of her here for me to get together and know her through her sons. But part of them is gone that I never found and I never will find, but she'll always be in my heart.
Next, a cunning and disturbed child molester is added to the FBI's 10 most wanted list. Forty years ago, the Federal Bureau of Investigation initiated its 10 most wanted list to alert the public of the most dangerous criminals in America. Now from Washington, D.C., a special appeal by FBI Director William Sessions.
Since 1950, 125 fugitives on the FBI's 10 most wanted list have been captured, thanks to your help. Tonight, with this broadcast of Unsolved Mysteries, we are announcing the most recent addition to the most wanted list. He is Kenneth Robert Stanton, who is wanted on charges of child molestation, burglary, unlawful flight to avoid prosecution, and impersonating a police officer. Please watch carefully.
In 1964, Kenneth Robert Stanton was convicted of child molestation. He was committed to a state mental hospital in Ionia, Michigan. Stanton was diagnosed as a criminal sexual psychopath. A few years later, Stanton was declared fit to re-enter society and set free. In 1989, Kenneth Stanton was identified by a young girl in Jackson, Mississippi. The events she described matched the modus operandi of numerous molestations attributed to Stanton.
Kenneth Robert Stanton quite frequently scouts an upper middle class white neighborhood and carefully selects a house where a victim is quite often home alone, usually a young white female between the ages of 7 and 12, and his job as a traveling salesman permits him time to do this. He is careful to approach the house so as not to disturb anybody. He usually wears a conservative suit. He's nice looking, he's well dressed. Quite often, Stanton comes to the front door of the house, presents himself as a person of authority, and quite often shows a badge as though he were a policeman dressed in plain clothes.
Hi, is your mother home?
No.
Well, I'm Officer Tom Coles. I'm with the local police department. We're helping out the county health service. There's been a report of contaminated milk in the area, and I'd like to come in and check if I could.
I'm not supposed to let strangers in the house.
Well, I'm not a stranger. I'm a policeman. I've been up and down the neighborhood all day checking your neighbor's icebox for the milk and the expiration date.
He often has a clipboard and indicates to the child in the house that he's taking a survey or that he's looking for contaminated milk and that he is there to test the milk in the refrigerator.
Do you know where your milk is coming from?
No.
Well, that's even more reason I should come in and check. It'll only take a minute.
If a young person would resist entry, Stanton quite often displays a bag of marijuana or a marijuana cigarette, stating that he found this on the front porch and he's entitled to search the house for evidence.
Well, how do I know that you're really a policeman?
Well, here's my badge.
He has a high IQ and he's very intelligent. And he's able to gain their confidence to get inside the house.
I'll be gone.
Okay.
All right.
Once he's inside and he's determined that the children or child is alone, he blindfolds them frequently. Quite often he uses eye drops and a thermometer, possibly for a distraction. It's at that time then that he continues on and assaults the children. In the summer of 1989, at Jackson, Mississippi, Stanton was in the house of a young white female attempting an assault when she screamed and scared him away. When he ran out of the house, a neighbor boy saw him jump into a car and correctly wrote down his license tag number. Thereafter, police were able to use that license number and identify that car as being registered to Kenneth Robert Stanton of Mobile, Alabama.
Christy, what I need you to do is I need you to look at each and every picture and think in your mind what this man looks like. And then look at each and every picture and pick out the picture that looks like him, okay?
The young girl who was assaulted on that day thereafter picked out a photograph of Stanton from a spread presented to her by the Jackson, Mississippi Police Department.
That's the man.
That's the man?
That's him.
After the Jackson, Mississippi assault, Stanton apparently traveled east through Alabama and Georgia and committed several crimes before he was identified at Houston County, Georgia. There were identifications of Stanton at Jackson, Mississippi and Columbus, Mississippi, as well as Tuscaloosa, Alabama, Leesburg, Georgia, Douglasville, Georgia, and Warner Robins, Georgia. Stanton is suspected of at least 11 child molestations from Mississippi, Alabama, and into Georgia. After reviewing a number of these cases and looking at Stanton's history from the early 1960s, we were able to conclude that he apparently was a lifelong child molester and probably could be described as a serial child molester.
Kenneth Robert Stanton is 52 years old, approximately 6 feet tall and weighs 170 pounds. He has blue eyes and brown thinning hair. He usually wears glasses and occasionally sports a mustache and beard. Stanton travels frequently and works as a heavy equipment salesman. He is known to have relatives in Indiana. In December of 1989, his car was found abandoned in Terrysburg, Ohio. Update. Kenneth Robert Stanton has been captured. Within minutes of our broadcast, several viewers called our telecenter to report that Stanton was living in a trailer park in Moraine, Ohio with his wife. They had been married just a few weeks earlier. Local police and FBI agents arrived at Stanton's trailer only to learn that he himself had seen our broadcast and fled. Stanton's wife and neighbors were stunned.
I've talked to my son and I've had him in front of the house, staying in the yard just in case he come back.
You know, I don't want someone like that running around the streets at all. You know, anyone that does anything like that should be put away.
5 days later, Stanton was identified in Rock Hill, South Carolina, after he allegedly attempted to molest a 9-year-old girl.
Based on seeing the segment on the program, coupled with a police report, we suspected there's a strong possibility that Stanton was in Rock Hill or somewhere in this area. And we proceeded on that assumption that he was possibly staying at a local motel.
2 days later, FBI agents spotted Stanton's car in the parking lot of this motel.
After identifying the vehicle, we established the surveillance of the motel with FBI agents and York County Sheriff's Department detectives.
Incredibly, a check with the motel office revealed that Stanton had registered under his own name.
He had indicated to the clerk previously that he wanted to stay an additional week, but he also wanted to move to the main building. The clerk, at our direction, called his room, told him the new room was ready and he could move. When Stanton emerged from his room, we arrested him. We asked Stanton his name. He said, "You know who I am." And he indicated that he was not a threat to us, that he was only a threat to himself. He did indicate that the following day was his birthday.
Next week, Unsolved Mysteries falls on Halloween. In keeping with that tradition, four intriguing mysteries of eerie people and events which cannot be explained. Scores of witnesses in South Carolina say they have encountered legendary ghost called the Gray Man. Some even claim that he has saved their homes by warning them of approaching hurricanes. We'll also meet a woman named Katie, whose apparent psychic powers have left eyewitnesses baffled and skeptics crying fraud. On Halloween, just 2 years ago, 29-year-old David Stone set forth on a spiritual odyssey in the bleak desert in New Mexico. He never returned. Authorities are still perplexed by a trail of mystical clues he left behind. Join us on Halloween for a special edition of Unsolved Mysteries.